for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's August 2021, and this is episode 248, which is a conversation about the 17th century poem by John Milton called Paradise Lost. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Stephen Mitchell, who has a PhD in humanities from Faulkner University and who teaches English at Covenant Day School in North Carolina. Stephen has written a literary apologetics article for the Christian Research Journal in the print edition of Volume 44, Number 2. His article is called Myself Am Hell, Rebellion and Gratitude in Milton's Paradise Lost. If you're not already a subscriber and would like to read his article, please subscribe to the journal at our website, equip.org. Stephen, it's good to have you on.
Thank you, Melanie. It's good to be here again.
Well, as I mentioned, Stephen has written an article in the Volume 44, Number 2 issue of the Christian Research Journal, which is out now. And his article is in our Literary Apologetics series. And so we sometimes occasionally publish these, and I bet some people are wondering, well, why would we care about literary apologetics? That seems rather stuffy or very academic. And specifically, his article is about John Milton, who has written one of the most famous poems ever written called Paradise Lost. And even as someone who was an English literature major, even at a very secular university, that was definitely one of the poems that we spent some time studying. So who was John Milton, first of all? And as I said, why would he be interesting at all to the apologist, and why should literary apologetics even matter to the Christian?
Yeah, good set of questions. John Milton was a 17th century British poet. He was active under the short-lived British Commonwealth, even during the time of Oliver Cromwell. But of course, he preceded and succeeded that time as well as a writer. John Milton is a Christian poet, though there are some certainly parts of his doctrine that Orthodox Christianity might take some exceptions to. There are some who think he is a proponent of the doctrine that the Son is subordinate rather than equal to the Father in terms of his being. But those are kind of the niceties of scholarship that get argued about. Milton was a genius. Paradise Lost is, you know, a roughly 12,000-line poem. John Milton, and it's all in blank verse, and John Milton composed it by dictation after he went blind. So that kind of just gives an indication of the man's intellect. It was towering. You know, what makes him of interest, just aside from being one of the world's great poets, and Paradise Lost especially being one of the world's great, great poems, it's an epic poem, is that Milton was deeply literate theologically and philosophically. And his poem addresses what would have been a contemporary problem. In historical terms, we call it a modern problem. It addresses many of them, but does so through the medium of, you know, a very traditional Christian story, through the story of the creation and fall of man in the Garden of Eden, thus the title Paradise Lost. So he is considered foundational to the English literary canon. I mean, he's ranked there with Geoffrey Chaucer and William Shakespeare as kind of the three anchor points of the British canon. He was powerfully influential. His poem on the Romantic Age of the late 18th and early 19th century. And, you know, he manages to get at deep human problems. And I guess that's where I would segue into the question about literature and the apologist. I tend to think literary apologetics might be the least stuffy, honestly, of the apologetics, because I think that literature it's less specialized in terms of its accessibility than, you know, sometimes philosophy or the sciences can be. So literature is that place where questions of human existence and the questions that living in this world bring up, which include questions of the nature of God, the nature of humanity, the nature of good and evil, of morality, of, you know, whether there is or is not something after this world, the moral development of human beings, all of that gets portrayed, sketched out, and theological questions, philosophical questions, existential questions, they get treated in this kind of robust and dramatic way in narrative, whether it's, plays or poems or fiction forthright. So that's why I think it should be a problem. They give us this picture. They're not ideas walking around in clothes. If you have a book like that, you've got an allegory, and it's often, not always, poor literature, but you do get to see humans motivated by ideas, for sure, acting. And that's an important way of evaluating ideas. And so that's, I think, why literary apologetics specifically is important. Milton, you won't find many poets more deeply connected to the Christian tradition in all of its long and beautiful history. You will rarely find a poet as philosophically astute as him. And so you get to this poem especially, and this is another place where John Milton might be something of a cautionary tale as well to apologists. So the poem is a poem, a gorgeous, narrative epic. It's extraordinary, but it's also an argument. And it claims to be an argument. In the very, in the opening lines, the narrator of the poem says that his purpose, right, is to assert eternal providence and justify the ways of God to man. And, he recognizes that this is an extraordinary undertaking. He even claims that it's an aim that exceeds the aim of the classical epic poets like Homer and Virgil. And there's some sense in which, right, this is what apologists do. They try to justify the ways of God to man. But, there's also a tone of hubris to me always in that line of the poem, that someone would take it upon himself or herself to think that he could do this, right, that he could justify the ways of God to man. And certainly our reason can do some of this, but there's going to be parts of the ways of God that exceed our abilities, I think, to justify. And sometimes Milton, I say this because sometimes Milton, even in this poem, probably doesn't do a grand job. One of the places he's often criticized is of his portrait of God the Father, just coming across as very sort of authoritarian and kind of unfeeling and really kind of just harsh very often in the portrait that the poem has. And so, the attempt to justify the ways of God to man, maybe gets undercut a little bit by presenting this picture of what looks like just kind of a mean being. I think there are some nuanced readings of him, of that section, that can overcome some of that. But to just be careful. Like, if John Milton couldn't justify the ways of God to man without making some mistakes, then we need to, a genius of his caliber, all of us who in any way undertake that, it's just to remind us, I think, to be humble, right? Because, we are dealing with, the triune God, the infinite, the omnipotent, the omniscient, and that is ever going to be beyond our grasp to, fully conceive or fully do justice to. So that's a long answer to your question.
Well, this, as we mentioned, this poem was published quite a long time ago. In fact, it's been more than 350 years. It was first published in 1667, and it has over 10,000 lines of verse. So it is quite long. And before we get to unpack this, you mentioned that, this poem has kind of got a narrative to it, and some people might not know that it's got these two different parts. One is about Satan and one is about Adam and Eve. And you just mentioned briefly that it's about the story in the garden in Genesis. And I also mentioned, just to say again, that Stephen's article specifically is called Myself Am Hell, Rebellion and Gratitude in Milton's Paradise Lost. So there's a lot there. What makes this particular poem that's more than 350 years old important for the contemporary reader? Why should the contemporary person in 2021, in the 21st century, even consider reading it? Especially, not everybody was humanities major or an English major where they would read this, or maybe even didn't read it in high school. So why should they interact with this piece of literature?
Well, it is demanding, for sure. And, getting acclimated to the style of it, and, it's high style and a bit of an arcane diction and certainly the syntax and structure. it's deeply elusive, both to classical and, you know, biblical traditions. So all of these can present challenges to contemporary readers. One place I think it's especially important is in the fact that I find that the character of Satan really captures what a free being is popularly conceived of as looking like, I suppose, in our modern and even now contemporary times. You know, he is this creature who is determined to make himself, to be author of himself, to be his own God, if you will. And he certainly isn't going to be subordinate to anybody. And so I find that the character of Satan, as portrayed by Milton here, and you know, that he manifests very powerfully a certain vision of freedom that I think is powerfully at work in our world. And I think there are problems with this vision of freedom, this sense of absolute ontological autonomy, that I determine who and what I am. I am my own creator. And nobody, not just another human, but no being whatsoever, sort of has the right to expect anything particular of me. I want to be equal with God. That's the great claim of Paradise Lost. And to be subordinate to anything is to be, in Satan's mind, a slave. So freedom conceived solely and only as absolute autonomy of the will to do as one pleases, to shape one's own being and existence, to determine what is right and what is wrong. I think that these are ideas that are current. They're powerfully current. And what Milton provides is a deep critique of that vision. What are its implications? And one of those is that declaration which I have used in the title, where in a rare moment of honesty, the character of Satan says, "Myself am hell," right? That in asserting this absolute independence from God, he doesn't recreate heaven, but he actually, you know, creates around him and within him and himself becomes a kind of locus of perpetual torment. And so that this vision, the idea being that this vision of freedom that we so sort of unconsciously accept today has, I think, some deep implications for kind of internal torment and external torment for us. And so that is sort of a long way toward, you know, why I think he's relevant for contemporary readers. Now, he's probably relevant in many, 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 many other ways too. A poem of this richness certainly doesn't have one point of relevance, but that's the one I have been focused on in my own study of him, and certainly in this article that we're talking about.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. This is episode 248, and our guest today is Dr. Stephen Mitchell. He has written a literary apologetics article in the print issue, volume 44, number 2 of the Christian Research Journal. His article is called "Myself Am Hell, Rebellion and Gratitude in Milton's Paradise Lost." If you're not already a subscriber, you can read his article when you subscribe to our journal at our website, equip.org, and a subscription is $33.50. Now, speaking of subscriptions, we have been running a contest to get more reviews on Apple Podcasts. We're in the 60s right now, I think 63, and our goal by the end of this year is to have 100. Now, the fastest way you can help us reach that goal is just to give us a starred review. It literally takes seconds. Or if you have just a few more minutes, maybe just a minute, if you could write a written review, that helps. And anyone who's written a review that is a short sentence or two will be entered in to this contest to receive a gift subscription for free, or you can give it to someone else or your pastor. And right now, there's only one person who's done so since the beginning of July. So I'd say their odds are pretty good that they would get this subscription. That is, if we can get to 100 reviews. And the purpose of getting to 100 reviews is that this way, the more reviews we have, the more our podcast is suggested to people who are looking for content like this. And the other way you can help us out, the biggest way, is just tell a friend. The more people that hear about this podcast, the better it is, because we get more listeners and we are able to let everyone know about the content that we have to help equip them in Christian apologetics. In addition, another way you can help us, which would just be a few moments of your time, is just to share this content, this episode, or any of your favorite episodes on your social media feeds. So thank you.
Well, now I want to get into actually talking about the content of this poem. So in Paradise Lost, how does Milton specifically portray God? And why is that important? I know, you know, there's a focus on Satan. We talked about Adam and Eve and their story in this, but how does God come across in the poem?
Yeah. So it's interesting. The poem opens with the first character, other than the narrator to talk, is actually Satan. And he and his followers, the other, you know, fallen angels, are given voice first. And you would think that that might sort of foreground them as the most important characters, but it's interesting that they speak from Milton's conception of hell, you know, this lake of fire. And this relates to the portrayal of God, because what he's using is this classical technique for epic poetry called in medias res, or in the middle of, where the poet will start the poem in the middle of the action, and then sort of take in different books that follow, he will go back and sort of fill in the backstory. So what happens then is that the poem opens when Satan and his angels have been cast out of heaven and are cast into hell and are slowly trying to regather their wits and their strength about them after they have been so summarily defeated. And this is important for the portrait of who God is, because if we go back to a part I referenced earlier, to assert eternal providence being the purpose of the poet, what this opening scene does in part in terms of how it portrays God is Satan is defeated from the opening point of the poem. He's been beaten. His rebellion has failed. And God the Father stands triumphant. And so the action of the poem, you know, already suggests that God, whatever else he may be, right, as the poem develops, he's clearly the most powerful being. Right? There's nothing that can withstand him. So there's part of it. Then as the poem develops, now as Satan speaks, it's fascinating. As he speaks throughout book one, he refers to God the Father often, but he never refers to him as God. Those words never come out of his mouth, but he primarily refers to him in terms of a kind of conquering dictator. He calls him the tyrant. He will refer to him as the all-powerful. He will refer to him as ruler, dictator, these forms of words. And so his vision of God is as of somebody who has unjustly crushed someone who has equal right to reign with him, right? Satan's claim is an ontological claim, right? That my being is equal to God's. He just happened to be the strongest. What he's trying to do, what Satan is trying to do, is kind of portray God as a bully, right? So, you know, if you just take the schoolyard, you've got a bully with who's really, really strong and maybe another kid who isn't as strong. You know, our assumption is that they are equal ontologically. They are both human beings. They are both equal. That bully's extra strength doesn't justify his, you know, his brutal treatment of the weaker person. And this is how Satan is trying to characterize God the Father or God the Almighty. Now, Milton certainly offers a different perspective of that. When the focus of the poem, the action shifts into the heavens, God the Father himself speaks for himself and talks about, points out the great glory, the great beauty, the great goodness, you know, the great power that he granted Satan and all the other creatures and human beings themselves, that he gave them all that they needed to remain, you know, righteous and sort of in perfect happiness, and that that was, you know, relinquished by them, that he stands faultless, if you will, for it. That is a place, you know, where he can still even kind of come across to readers as a little bit harsh, a little bit self-justifying. But I think for Milton, it's a logical point more than anything that he's trying to sort of put in poetic terms. He's, you know, he's trying to navigate this tension between, you know, sort of all-ruling providence and sovereignty and human freedom. And he's concerned to sort of keep God free of any sort of moral responsibility for either the fall of Satan or the fall of humanity. Later in the poem, and again, this is a little more by implication, when Adam and Eve are, you know, wrestling with having fallen, right, having disobeyed the command and experiencing the angst and the alienation and the existential dread that comes with that, you know, Michael, comes, one of the archangels, and speaks these words of hope to them. But he's speaking on behalf of God the Father. And so even there, the portrait is of still of a God who is deeply involved with, deeply concerned to restore a fallen creation and to defeat this great enemy of humanity who is, you know, and rebel against himself, who is Satan. So that doesn't do anything like justice to the portrait of God. He is powerful. He is in control. He is merciful. But this is maybe one of those places where readers may have a little hard time sort of warming up to him, to a picture of God the Father. Milton is not perhaps terribly good at making him approachable. And maybe he doesn't want to, right? Maybe he's trying to emphasize that great otherness of God, but he isn't a terribly approachable being in this. But he's powerful and he's righteous and he does seek the good and the salvation of his creatures. And he is amply generous as well, right? Full of creative, you know, a power to create beauty, the world that he creates and the great gifts of it. So there's generosity in him. There is power in him. There is providence in him. So there is love in him, though it looks at times rather austere.
So I think when we talk theologically about the story of Adam and Eve in Genesis 1 through 3, just even with the founding of, you know, creation of the world, et cetera, there's always the question of free will and freedom, and in particular, human freedom. So in this particular poem, what is Milton's vision of freedom? Because that's always the big question when we come to this story.
It is. And it's a complex question. I'll just lay that out there. Navigating it is, you know, it's one of those questions you can come back to and come back to and come back to with the poem and, you know, see new nuances every time. Satan, as I alluded earlier, he embraces this notion of freedom as kind of absolute autonomy, ontological autonomy. And this is what, in some terms, we might call negative freedom. And what that means, it doesn't necessarily mean anything bad. It means freedom conceived of as the absence of limits of any sort. And for Satan, you know, this matters because for him, God the Father is this limit that prevents his being, you know, as great and grand as he could otherwise be. So he asserts. When he can't meet God sort of toe to toe, right, pound for pound, blow for blow, when it's clear that God is more powerful and has overruled him, Satan decides to set up what he calls a rival empire. And to him, this will be the place where he decides, you know, really he's trying to found a cosmos is really what it is. It's almost a kind of counter creation narrative, this cosmos in hell. And here he will reign at the top. He will decide what is good and evil. He will decide, you know, what is done and what is not done. He wants to be the top dog. And there's some inconsistency in him here because when he's arguing against the authority of God the Father, of course, you know, he's claiming that any sort of subordination is, you know, an unjust infringement of his freedom. When he sets up the hierarchy in hell, you know, he makes sure he's at the top of it and everyone else is subordinate to him. So there's an irony, there's a paradox, there's a contradiction in Satan's vision of freedom. But he wants absolute power to determine the nature of reality. I mean, that's how far it really it goes with him. Now, this desire is undercut all the way through because, and this goes to the larger vision of freedom, because an astute reader will see that everything which he chooses because it's the opposite of what God the Father has ordained. And so Satan's vision, while he asserts himself to be, he claims to be sort of absolutely free of God the Father, which is why he says maybe his most famous lines are better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven. So while he claims that he is absolutely independent of God, every choice he makes is seen to be determined by its opposition to what God has already done. Right. So his choices are in that sense derivative and therefore dependent. And so his great claim to autonomy, to being self-existent, to existing by his own kind of fiat or affirmation, we say one of the things we classically say of the triune God is that he is eternally self-existent. And Satan wants to give this picture of himself, but the poem continually undercuts that, to the point that it's so clear that Satan's, you know, own empire is really dependent for its form, for its values, on its opposition to the divine, to God's cosmos, that, you know, if he actually were to succeed in overthrowing God the Father, there's no chance he can do it in the poem, but were he would overthrow himself. I think it was Lewis who said of him that he's like the scent of a flower trying to destroy the flower. You know, if the scent of a flower ever conceived something so ridiculous as to destroy the flower from which it emanated, you know, the scent of the flower would be gone too. It could not exist past that point. So what the poem ends up saying is that creaturely freedom, and by that I mean any being that has its existence because of God, is a limited and dependent freedom. It's important that we are free. We are morally free. We can choose, you know, to follow right and wrong, those sorts of things. But we don't get to determine the nature of reality, and we don't get to determine the nature of morality, of good and evil, of what is good and what is evil, what is right and what is wrong. Because we are created, we are necessarily contingent, and we are necessarily recipients of identity and of being. And that imposes limitations on us. And so the question of freedom becomes not, you know, how free of limitation can I be? There are unjust limitations, right? And I really think for Milton, what Satan pictures is, you know, in human terms, even though he's an angelic, demonic character, in human terms, he pictures human political leaders who try to acquire to themselves powers and rights over human beings that they really don't belong having. But freedom is not the absolute absence of limitations upon anyone's power or anyone's right, you know, to do whatever he or she wants. But it is this other term, which we call positive freedom. And again, that doesn't necessarily mean it's better than negative freedom, though I think there are arguments for it, but that it is the capacity to choose what is actually good. That's the fundamental freedom to which creatures, angelic or human, that's the freedom that they are due. And that's the freedom that Adam and Eve have to learn how to reclaim at the end of Paradise Lost. That's the freedom they've lost in disobeying the divine command not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And they lose control of their passions, they lose control of their emotions, they lose control of their appetites, and those things prevent their doing what is good and what would lead them to peace. And so freedom in Paradise Lost, at least one way of understanding it, is this perennial tension between negative and positive freedom, with Milton arguing that at least on a deep ontological and moral level, spiritual level, the political question is a little bit more complicated. Positive freedom is the ideal that we should be seeking. Negative freedom is at best the servant of positive freedom. It is that which keeps us, you know, free of interference so that we can, through spiritual discipline and grace, become capable of knowing and choosing what is good. So the poem, I think, does that. Now, I will say there's a long history of people, starting with William Blake and certainly amongst many of the early romantics and the later romantics like Shelley and Byron, who read it quite the opposite, who see the poem as really being on the side of Satan, and that throwing off all sorts of shackles and authority is really the freedom that humans need. I think they're wrong. I think they've read it incorrectly. And I think, again, I'll rely on just one really astute reader of Milton was C.S. Lewis. He made the observation in his book, A Preface to Paradise Lost, that with Milton, it may be that there is something in him sort of psychologically and emotionally that is on the side of Satan, but that intellectually, philosophically, he knows that that vision of freedom which Satan espouses is really destructive. And I think that's a wonderfully human way to read it, because it indicates that Milton, like all of us, is often torn, right, between what we know to be good and what might nevertheless appeal to us. So anyway, people should just know that the reading of Milton in A Freedom That I'm Giving is just not necessarily universal, and there is a good deal of debate over which vision is the reigning vision in the poem.
Speaking of Satan, he's portrayed in a specific way, you know, as an unhappy character in this poem. So why is he perpetually unhappy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this goes to what he has chosen to be. And to me, this is part of why I can't see his vision of freedom as being ascendant in the poem. Satan's vision of himself is based in rebellion. It is essentially, it starts with a no. So one way of understanding this is if we remember again the biblical narrative where God is creating the world, right? And at each stage, he looks at what he's created and he says it's good. And then, of course, with the creation of humanity, he says it's very good. This goodness is more an ontological affirmation, I would say, than a moral affirmation. In other words, he's making a declaration about the deep substance of what he's made. It's right, if you would. It's good that it exists as it exists. And at the root of this goodness is the joy, then, that creatures experience in their existence, in their being. And so creation, it is an expression of joy. It is an expression of love. It is a place of perpetual happiness. Unless somebody conceives, and there's an element of mystery here, which is, I think, true to the nature of evil, unless a being conceives a resentment at being the kind of creature that it is. And that's what happens to Satan. It becomes offensive to him that there should be any being that exists greater than him. And so while he claims that he is the equal of God, he isn't. Like, the poem is clear, he isn't. And so what looks like a sort of egocentric self-love, and certainly in some sense is, becomes unavoidably in Satan, self-hate. He can't love what he is, because what he is, however powerful, right, as, you know, in some understandings of him through scripture, he's, you know, was at least the most powerful, the most beautiful, the most glorious of God's creatures. You know, there was nothing, no one grander than him except for God himself. But he turns against that, right? And happiness is in the poem, joy in the poem, goodness in the poem are elements of being as given by God. They are just qualities that inhere in being as God brings it into existence. Satan does not want to exist as one of God's creatures. And so he can't be happy because he can't take any joy in what God has created. Because all of it speaks to God's power and God's right and God's authority, and he has determined to reject all of that. It's that same sense of being derivative, right? Happiness is a quality of the cosmos and of being as God has intended them. And so Satan has to choose, literally choose unhappiness. He has to make that a kind of ideal for himself because it's what's left. And of course, it's just negative. It doesn't really have any substance. It is unhappiness, right? There's no positive content in it. It's the loss of something. And so he's perpetually unhappy because to be happy, to have joy, would require gratitude. It would require thankfulness for what he is. And that's all it would require, just being happy that he's been given this glorious existence. He cannot do that. And so he cannot know happiness. And that's why, like, Satan's rebellion may be powerful. It does give evidence of his great power, but it is such a dark, such an unhappy, such a despairing and just perpetually miserable existence that I cannot see the poem as being on his side, because the poem would have to affirm that sort of unhappiness in order for it to affirm him as a rebel. So happiness is the condition of the soul in harmony with God. Unhappiness is therefore the condition of the soul out of harmony with God. And Satan has determined in this poem that he will not be in harmony with God. And so he embraces his unhappiness. And this is why he makes the claim, "Myself am hell." He accepts the curse of God. He really sort of embraces it, really. And he resolves to remain unhappy. And at one point in the poem declares, "Evil, be thou my good." And of course, what he's again saying is that, and since the poem is really built on an Augustinian conception of good and evil, which is that evil is parasitic of good, it has no substance of itself, he's embracing just the negation of everything. He's trying to turn negation into something you can build upon. And of course, this is perpetually frustrating.
Well, the subtitle of your article, "Rebellion and Gratitude in Milton's Paradise Lost," how does gratitude relate to this discussion that we've just had about freedom in the poem?
Well, gratitude, it turns out in the poem, is something owed God the Father. Satan conceives it as a debt. He uses that word, that it is a debt, endless and perpetual. But it is also, and he concedes this, a debt that is paid simply by acknowledging that it's owed. In other words, really what it comes down to is this, that yes, every being which is honestly, like every being created by God, and as Christians we would acknowledge that's every being, owes God a debt of gratitude, because it is only by his power, by his generosity, by his love, a kind of donation of being, making room for us, that we exist. In other words, our existence is gift, unmerited, and therefore itself a part of grace. Gratitude is really only the kind of just a joyful enjoyment of that, acknowledging it and being grateful that we have the chance to exist. But that existence is necessarily, there's no way around it, it's limited, because we're not self-existent. But if you conceive freedom as the absolute absence of limits, your own existence becomes an affront to your freedom. Now, if you understand freedom as being able to choose what is good, then an absolute absence of limits is not necessary. What you need to know is not that you can do anything. What you need to know is, what is good for me to do? Gratitude bends us toward this positive freedom, and positive freedom supports gratitude, whereas negative freedom, when it becomes too radical, when it becomes an ontological demand, it bends us toward negative freedom, and it turns us against ourselves. Our existence becomes an affront to us because our existence has limits built into it, limits that our will can wish to overcome. Gratitude, by contrast, recognizes that I am a gift to the universe, to myself, from God, and that the right response to a gift is to be thankful for it. And the root, I think, in the poem, for me at least, when I read it, is that it is gratitude which enables us to reorient our notion of freedom more than a reorientation of freedom will make us grateful. It could happen that way. But just this developing sense that the world that is beautiful and lovely and wonderful and abundant and a gift, and to just appreciate it will do more to prepare us for a spiritually fruitful notion of freedom than anything else. I think I say it more succinctly in the article than I'm saying it right now, but gratitude and positive freedom go hand in hand. Gratitude just is, in the poem, the rightful stance of a created being. just as, just by analogy, when you give your child a gift of some sort, gratitude is the rightful response of that child to that gift. And gratitude recognizes that we are needy creatures, right? That we do not of ourselves have everything that we need. And that then comes also with right responsibility to the one who gives us the gift of being, in this poem and in the Christian tradition, that being God the Father. So if we wish to retain this old and venerable and very important notion of freedom in the Christian tradition, of positive freedom, which is the power to choose what is good, that being true human freedom, then we cannot allow the notion of negative freedom to have too big a part in our notion of freedom, because it will undercut gratitude and it will undercut our sense that a God who places limitations on us does so only as they are inherent in the form of our being, in the form of our existence. And to reject those structures, those limitations, is to reject our own being. It is to become ungrateful. And in the words of God the Father, he calls them at one point ingrates in the poem himself, as Adam and Eve reject, you know, the rule against the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
What about, you know, we've spent a lot of time talking, you know, you unpacked the character of Satan for us. Mm-hmm. So how does he use those, you know, questions about freedom and gratitude to actually, you know, tempt Adam and Eve? Because yeah, that's a big part of the biblical story and, mm-hmm, and also, you know, this poem as well.
Yes. And I'll try to do this one quickly. Really interesting, when he tempts Eve, he starts out with these titles and he calls her queen, sovereign, empress of the universe. And throughout the temptation, he keeps sort of swelling the titles that he gives her. And in each of these, he is essentially flattering her and telling her that she is, you know, grander and grander and grander, swelling her vision of herself. And he includes with that, right, this argument that if they really are rulers of the world, right, as the Genesis account says, right, having dominion, they can't possibly be rulers and be subordinate at the same time. And that therefore, the implication is that God has hoodwinked them, right? That he's told them a lie, that he has set up this kind of fake system of dependence whereby he's trying to keep them from their rightful place as God. So he, in other words, he draws them to question whether their status as rulers of the world subordinate to God is really a good status. And not question in the sense of let's think about it, question it in the sense of, you know, you've been duped. This can't possibly be the best form of existence for you. God is keeping something from you. And so he feeds ingratitude, is what he does, this sense of dissatisfaction with the world as God has given it to them. And he argues, you know, that they should have a different kind of freedom. They should have a kind of freedom that knows no limits, right? There should be no restrictions upon them, or they can't be, you know, the rulers of this world. And so the notion of freedom that he feeds them is that of absolute negative, right, freedom, ontological autonomy, nobody higher than them, nobody determining what they should or should not do. And I think that's part of the way he reads the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, that humans themselves will take upon themselves to try to determine what is good and what is evil. And then with that, in order to sort of win a hearing, if you will, for his argument about freedom, he feeds this sense of ingratitude, of having lost or been kept from something good. And with that, he's able to win a hearing from them and to get them to consider that he is right, that they have been duped, that they are wrong, and then, of course, to violate the one prescription that God gave them, which was not to eat of the tree. And so they fall. So Satan feeds ingratitude, uses that to win an opening for a different vision of freedom. And when he combines those two together, he successfully tempts Adam and Eve to violate God's one proscription against the eating of the fruit.
what is Milton's characterization of Adam and Eve after the fall? I mean, how are they not despairing of their situation of, you know, having been kicked out of Eden?
So despair is really the first, you know, is where they are headed for sure after this. They are disoriented. They have lost their inner peace. They have lost their sense of connection to God. They are just adrift. And life doesn't seem worth living. Eve at one point even contemplates suicide in this. Adam becomes this kind of petulant accuser of God. How dare you? Who do you think you are for having created me? It's a little bit odd, but he goes on and on in this. And they are spinning out of control, overwhelmed by passions and things that had never before overwhelmed them. Lust, spite, anger, fear. And the Archangel Michael comes, and he does a number of things that are worth talking about, but one thing he does very simply is promise a savior who will restore them. And this is important because it once again puts gift at the center of God's relationship to humanity. The gift of existence, as it was given, was rejected. Right? That's what Satan rejected, and that's what Adam and Eve reject in the poem of limited existence. But this savior that's promised is another gift. And it's that gift which begins to stabilize them, that there will be one who will restore them to the paradise they have lost. And so that's the main way that they are saved from despair. And that's why, again, I say that the poem returns to gratitude, because it is in gratefulness for that promise that they begin to sort of win some control back, some self-control again, back over their, you know, their storming lusts and passions. And then Michael, the archangel, sort of gives them instruction in spiritual disciplines, you know, as a way to, you know, with God's grace, to sort of regain a measure of the paradise back, the inner paradise that they have lost, as they anticipate, as they live in anticipation of a savior who will restore humanity to its, you know, the state that it has lost. And so, you know, this poem ends, on the one hand, you are waiting a savior that is another gift. And so gratitude is reborn in them. That's what's important. I think the most important thing that saves them from despair, and that gratitude reborn in them sort of reopens them to this vision of again, of positive freedom, but now through sort of very careful spiritual disciplines of becoming sort of, you know, more and more capable of choosing what is good as they learn to discipline themselves. Now, of course, the notion of grace is woven all through here, obviously, but the gift of God coupled with spiritual disciplines overcomes the despair that would otherwise have gone hand in hand with, you know, with if the loss of paradise had been perpetual, like without any sort of hope of it being won back. Had that not been there, they would have been forever sort of in the camp of Satan, right? Who is in his own mind the eternal rebel, right? Who will never give in.
Well, finally, I want to end with some fun rapid fire questions. So, Stephen, we've had this discussion about this classic work of literature. Is there another classic, like, novel, maybe a little bit more recent than 350 years ago, that you would recommend to our listeners to read? We're just waning in the days of summer, but someone might be able to get in one last read.
Yeah, I would say at this point, anything by Marilynne Robinson. Gilead, Home, Jack, which just came out in September, or Lila. Extraordinary American novelist and characters, poignant reading, but stories that have some more accessible beauty in them than maybe Paradise Lost does. I would recommend those.
Yes, those have become American classics almost. So I will second Gilead, because is the one I've read in that list. And so fill in the blank. I've had enough of...
today, coffee. I think I've had 32 ounces.
And have you visited any new places recently?
I went to Snowshoe, West Virginia about 2 months ago, which is odd to do in the summer because it's a ski resort, but did a lot of wonderful hiking up there with my friends, and it was about 30 degrees cooler up there than it was here in Charlotte where I live. So Snowshoe, West Virginia.
Well, thanks, Stephen, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you, Melanie. It was my pleasure.
You've been listening to episode 248 of the Postmodern Realities Podcast. Today, Dr. Stephen Mitchell joined me for a conversation about 17th century poet John Milton's epic poem, Paradise Lost. Stephen has written a literary apologetics article about this poem in the print issue, volume 44, number 2 of the Christian Research Journal. His article is called Myself in Hell, Rebellion and Gratitude in Milton's Paradise Lost. If you're not already a subscriber and would like to read his article, head on over to our website, equip.org, and you can subscribe to our journal for $33.50. Thank you. We'd like to connect to you, so please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man YouTube channel and join in the conversation in the comments section and in the live chat when we have premiere videos. Please follow the Bible Answer Man page on Facebook and on Twitter. You will find us at Hank Hanegraaff, Bible Answer Man, Christian Research Institute, and Christian Research Journal, as well as on Instagram at the Bible Answer Man account. You won't want to miss every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern when we live stream the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff at our website, equip.org. In addition, please subscribe to the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank gets out of the studio and into his study and engages in in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. You'll want to head on over to equip.org because there you're going to find thousands of free resources for you in articles and past broadcasts, our podcasts, and videos. And thank you for all the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute.